Blog Talk Radio.
Seven-year-old boy standing on the stoop. Had the teacher cut his hair, stealing ridicule. All he wanted was honor of his heritage. She tells him that he looks better now, 'cause she knows the damage that she did. If you'd only stop a minute, see the world through our eyes, we've seen things that you'll never see. Maybe it's not you that's so wise. Now the damage is done, and the damage is done. Forty-year-old man walking his kids to school. Boys driving by in a car, acting like a fool. Broken egg rolls down his arm to his daughter's hand. He can tell by the look on her face that she doesn't understand. If you'd only stop for a minute, see the world through our eyes, we see things that you'll never see. Maybe it's not you that's so wise. Now the damage is done, and the damage is done. And you tell us you're sorry, that you want to build a place we both can live. But how can we trust you? You keep doing the same things that you always did. Ninety-year-old man sitting on the stoop. Just got told his pain isn't worth that much. He's feeling ridiculed. Said according to our chart, he didn't suffer that much. Tears of shame and guilt pour out, caused by preacher's touch. If you'd only stop for a minute, see the world through our eyes, we've seen things that you'll never see. Maybe it's not you that's so wise, and the damage is done, and the damage is done. Damage is done, and the damage is done.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Fire Talk Production, produced by Nell Cole. This is Fire Talk, and I am your host today, Russ Letica. Joining me today again will be Frank Bush. You might remember that name. We've had him on the show back in August 26th, where we talked about the pros and cons of the residential school payouts. Well, today we got him back, and we're talking about the funding cuts that we believe, or we may not believe, and we'll find out at the end of the show, but we seem to think that there is a connection to the residential school payouts. So we brought Frank back on to talk some numbers and talk some statistics and what exactly is being cut and so on. But before I bring Frank on, I want to tell you a little bit about him. Frank is the senior, let me get to it. Hold on one second. I'm sorry. He's the senior salesman. He's the senior manager in the residential school payouts for one of the large legal firms that is handling these cases. And he's also from the Cree First Nation in northern Manitoba. And in his position, he has traveled to 56 of the 52 First Nations in Manitoba. And nationwide, he has visited approximately 200 First Nation communities. So Frank seems to be the man that has the on-the-ground, eye-to-eye, person-to-person contact. So with that, I'd like to welcome Frank back to the show.
Well, hey, Russ. It's great to be back on the show. I'm originally from the Nichisawayasi Cree Nation. Also, my family, I guess more recently, from the Opipanapewin First Nation. We only received our reserve status in the last 10 or so years. So it's a great honor for me to be on the show and represent my tribe, my people, and try to share a little bit about what I've seen out in the field with your listeners.
Absolutely, and we thank you for coming here with your expertise and speaking with us on the issues that affect so many of our brothers and sisters across Canada and even into the United States. These funding cuts, I mean, it's an uproar across Canada right now. What's going on?
Yeah, it's really kind of hit, I guess, the national spotlight, at least in the, First Nations community. It doesn't really seem that mainstream Canada seems terribly concerned. And, there's, a lot of speculation out there that that's part of what the residential school settlement was supposed to bring about, to kind of soften the mainstream Canadians' view on, funding for Aboriginal programming, and therefore maybe even, some might consider the existence of Aboriginal programming nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
So, we're seeing a lot more coverage, I guess, on the Aboriginal People's Television Network, and I guess on some of the social media, and quite a bit less of it in the mainstream media. So I'm kind of glad we're able to talk about it here with your listeners and kind of start getting the word out a little bit more about what the potential causes and effects of the situation are.
Well, I can tell you, in my perspective, I don't live within my community. I live within a city. I work within the assimilation, I would have to say. I have been assimilated. I am from a city. I work for a conglomerate, a corporation. So I would have to say that when we come into times like we have seen in the last 4 or 5 years, we see funding cut all over the place. Okay, we see programs for children and women cut, and social services cut, and so to the average person hearing this, it's like, well, everything's getting cut. But we come from a different perspective, I feel, and that perspective is there are treaty rights. And those treaty rights are connected to the resources of the land, as long as the sun shall shine and the water shall flow. So we come from a different perspective, and we don't come from a perspective of a poverty that we can work our way out of, because the poverty that Native Nations, First Nations, live in is a projected poverty. So this money is guaranteed through treaties to come to the nations and to come through, it's not guaranteed into the programs that we're going to talk about, but definitely into the nations, and there is funding cutting also there. So when we say it's not the same, those are the reasons why. It's not political. It's treated. These are agreements across the board to take care of First Nations, Natives, and their descendants. So what are we doing with the money? I mean, we're these cuts within Native communities only ignites the poverty that's already there. It will only cause more problems in the long run. So, Frank, let's start with where these funding cuts are starting or what you've heard, because I'm going to tell you, when I look on the Internet and I search these cuts, it's everywhere. It's touching everything.
Well, I guess most of the information out there is with regards to our national and regional Aboriginal representative bodies. So here in Canada, specifically the Assembly of First Nations, and then regionally some of our provincial organizations, such in, you know, in my territory here, the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. So in some cases, it seems like across the board, everybody seems to be losing in the neighborhood of 50% of their, you know, what we call core funding. So core funding is monies that are put in place to cover, I guess, mainly the administrative costs of operating that type of organization. Now, many of the salaries that are paid from those funds are used by people who are running other programs that, you know, funding sources may come from other places, including, you know, various charities or private contributions or, you know, grassroots fundraising. So one of the things that hasn't really been taken into consideration is that with, you know, some of the maybe layoffs that will occur naturally as a result of these funding cuts, a lot of the programming that those salaried people were providing will also be lost. And again, therefore, monies will be saved by the elimination of those programs that, you know, the Aboriginal organizations will no longer be able to staff. So core funding is very integral to, you know, to services being provided to First Nations people. And without the core funding, it's like ripping a person's heart out, really, in terms of the social programming being delivered. Because many of these individuals, you know, many friends of mine who work for these organizations representing First Nations, aren't going to be able to do their jobs. They're not going to be able to liaise or organize or coordinate with other bodies, charities, and you know, other NGO organizations in order to deliver the necessary services to First Nations people, both on and off reserve. So, based on APTN's research, some of the very specific information, it looks the best example being given is in my region here, the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs stands to lose about $2 million of its funding. Now, their annual budget isn't much more than that. This constitutes approximately an 80% cut to their annual funding. So, you know, that means that they will obviously be losing at least 80% of their programming and possibly laying off 80% of their staff. I'm not too sure exactly how many people work there today, but a few years back, I believe the I guess whatever you want to believe, I said the number was in the neighborhood of 200. So I'm really sure that's inaccurate. So, and then the amount of people that are affected by the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs and its various programming, both youth programming, on-reserve and off-reserve programming, you know, is going to be affected as well. So what I'm kind of really disturbs me is, you know, is where are these funding cuts coming from? You know, and I think maybe that's what we want to talk about today. You know, what are some of the root causes for that? Now, of course, and you bring up a very interesting point here because you know, everybody talks about the economy and you know, what the effects the economic development of Canada being. And this is a really good concern because I'm actually you know, just looking at the gross domestic product of Canada year over year. And based on that information, it's actually right available on Google here. I think we're going to be posting the data source there to the site. But it's actually been going up over the last 2 years. So right now we're hovering just below $1.4 trillion. So although the national spending has been reduced as a result of this government's budget, the actual product, you know, that some of these numbers should be based upon. You know, as you say, you know, the treaties are about the land and resources. Well, it seems like, you know, money is still being made off the lands and resources, regardless of what the Canadian public seems to think is happening with the economy. In a way, I think it's kind of fear-mongering because, yes, there are parts of the world, specifically, you know, Italy, Greece, Spain, and Portugal, that are suffering, you know, and kind of an economic, you know, meltdown in a way. And obviously, just recently, uh-huh. 2008, with the economic collapse in the United States, that's being used as kind of a fear-mongering to try to reduce, you know, funding sources, you know, to all government programming across the board.
Right.
I couldn't imagine any... organization, or I haven't heard of any other organizations that were losing 80% of their funding. Like, I couldn't imagine, you know, something like this happening to, like, a veterans organization or something to that effect. Then that would create more of a public outcry, and unfortunately, we're not really seeing that, you know, in the mainstream right now.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, you make a very good point, and that's why I brought it up about the economy and everything's being cut across the board. The problem is not everybody in this economy has been genocide. Not everyone in this economy has had their women stolen, murdered, no investigations, and not everyone in this economy has had their children stolen for 150 years. So there's a big difference. You need to, you know, I know you understand it, but I think the average person doesn't understand that. There should be a blanket of security, because that's what our treaties were meant to be, a blanket of security. You should be untouchable, because it's not supposed to come from a taxpayer, as we talked about before. It's supposed to come from the resources, and you're right, the resources are still there, because they certainly are still living the lifestyle that they've become accustomed to by stealing them. So that's where I come from on this issue, and I have no problem directing that straight back at them. So there's a lot of different paths that you can take in a conversation, but it's always best to keep it on the path. We're not talking about the population as a whole. Now we're talking about Native communities, because this is where the devastation is going to happen. You make another point. 70% of Native women live off reserve. So when these fundings are cut, these women are not within their own community for, I don't know, not financial support, emotional support, a lending ear or anything. So what they're doing is they're cutting funding to women who have no other resource but these programs that they're cutting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so once again, to me, I see a clear picture of attacking the women and then the children. And that's what I see in these funding cuts across the board. I see women and children, again, going to suffer under oppression. That's how I view it. Now, I know you're a little bit more educated than that, and you're going to come with a different angle, but when you break the words down to the bottom line, that's exactly what it is. You know what I mean?
And, you know, I do think a lot of people do lose touch with that, and I mean, you know, the bureaucrats and technocrats especially, where, you know, we do, you know, obviously talk a lot about numbers, and, you know, most people, like, you know, in my field don't ever have to equate those numbers to mm-hmm. actual individuals. Like, most of these government people never have to deal with the public. They don't have to deal with the front lines of people coming and saying, this is how your policy is affecting my life. You know, that's
right.
I guess
yeah.
they want to take a bird's eye view to everything, where you can't really see the suffering on the ground. You can just see the numbers in the spreadsheet and that. So that's kind of what I do, actually. I kind of do something very similar, but from a different perspective. And when you take the First Nations perspective at the same analysis, you're able to paint a much different picture. Because while the government of Canada is telling us that we're in a financial crisis or we're having these problems, meanwhile our gross domestic product is actually up, and you know our expenses are down. In the fiscal budgets from 2009-2010, total government spending was about $274.2 billion. That's an enormous amount of money, and that was actually brought down by approximately $4 billion the next year. So we haven't quite seen what 2012 is going to look like, but it may very well go the same way. So what I kind of see in the numbers here is that revenue is actually up. So the tax revenue has actually come up, about 17 billion, you know, the monies that the government takes in from the taxpayers. Now, we're still operating within a huge deficit. I mean, we are still talking about, you know, a deficit in the $40 billion range. But from the actual reduction in government spending, it's not I guess, you know, reflective of the not only the demographics of Canada in comparison to, you know, First Nations people and the mainstream, but also it fails to take into account the number of the First Nations people who have been affected by the residential school system and the, you know, the intergenerational effect which is suffering. So basically what I see is that the, you know, the government has taken, you know, it upon itself to announce these huge numbers to the Canadian public. Like we're saying, you know, the total residential school settlement is $4.6 billion. Well, to Joe Canadian on the street, that sounds like a huge number. But based on the actual process, based on the amount of time it's taking the federal government to move through this process and the amount of time that's coming, it's actually taken about 5 years now that they've been having these residential school hearings. And based on my information, on my calculations of publicly available information, it will take the government at least another 5 years to pay out the rest. So this $4.6 billion is actually being spread out over a 10-year period, you know, which makes a really big difference. So while we're telling Joe Canadian,
right,
oh, yeah, $4.6 billion out of your pocket, it's actually more like $460 million per year for 10 years. That makes up an insignificant fraction of the overall Canadian budget, whereas these programming cuts, even in the smallest sense, make up a much larger number, a much bigger number. Based on our 2006, you know, government budget, which unfortunately for Indian Affairs is the latest information I'm able to acquire, their annual budget in 2006 for Indian Affairs was $6.9 billion. So looking at that, I mean, you know, that's the monies that they're using are not much more over 10 years. It's less than, it's significantly less. It's about 66% of the total annual budget of what's spent on Indian Affairs each year. You know, which I believe, you know, it is just a fraction of the overall Canadian budget. And, you know, within reason, I mean, First Nations people make up, you know, a fraction of the Canadian public. So, you know, you can understand when the budgeting process is made that they are going to obviously have to take into account everybody in the country. My question always is do the numbers line up? You know, like, is everybody getting their fair share? And, you know, basing a lot of the calculations we're seeing in the news of that are based on, you know, annual budgets rather than the revenue. So the monies that are actually coming into Canada are not the same as the monies just coming into the government. So they try to put this cap on our organizations or on our services based on their budget, which is just numbers that they came up with, and it is not in any way equated or related to the actual gross domestic product. So to me that kind of creates a bit of a problem there when even just with the perspective that the that the mainstream community is looking at this with, you know.
Well, another way too is now I understand in these economic times that we're in that there is funding cutting. It's going to happen. The problem I see as a taxpayer and then as a First Nation person, I see funding going away as governments grow bigger. So it's not there's a lack of money, because the money that they're saving goes into producing larger governments with more salaries and more holiday pays and more severance pays and everything else. So when we look at it in that way, and you look at it as from a taxpayer's point of view, I don't understand why the light bulb don't go on. Why are we, the taxpayers, paying for this? Why isn't the government and the churches who produced it responsible? So there's no responsibility whatsoever in the TRC. I've established that in the last show, and I've said it on many shows I've been on. There is no truth in the Truth and Reconciliation. So as a taxpayer and the light bulb's burned out and they're not getting it, that they shouldn't be paying for this, that they should be loud with their government about it. The problem is, we as First Nation people have never started equally to begin with. We're already $1.4 billion under budget from any other child in Canada when it comes to education. You know, so when you start cutting funds of something that was already only getting 20 to 30% of what they should have been getting, it it's even more devastating because those numbers continue to climb higher and higher and higher. It's not like we started out equal, 50-50. We started out more like 10-90. And when you cut from the 10% and go even lower, it's going to devastate nations across Turtle Island. So I'm not understanding where there isn't a outrage and there isn't a scream, not a voice, a scream across Turtle Island yelling for emergency assistance. Call state of emergencies. I don't understand that.
Well, you know what? Recently we saw that actually happen, though, with in Attawapiskat with the housing crisis. And, you know, they're just gearing up for... They're gearing up for the next, you know, big round of it this year. As you know, the situation's actually become worse, you know, over the last year.
Worse,
I mean, they've
right.
even lost more housing. So, I mean, when they do declare a state of emergency, when they do call in the, you know, the Red Cross, the result is often is that they lose everything they had and were working with. Like, they were immediately put into third-party management by the Government of Canada.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think I'm wondering if that's got something to do with, apathy that we're seeing in the Aboriginal community, where you know there isn't a you know massive outrage. I think what it is that you know your average First Nations person who's basically just you know struggling to you know make ends meet,
yeah.
you know they see this these numbers on TV that are so unimaginable. I don't think we'll really see the outrage until they start to feel the effects, and
right.
I think the
yeah.
effects of the of these cuts are going to be felt. This winter, January, February, is when people will start to see it. And, you know, obviously, okay. usually by then, the media has lost interest in the story. And so I think the timing the government has used for these programming cuts could not have been better. I mean, this must have been analyzed by PhDs
yeah.
well above my head, you know, who have access to a lot more information. I mean, an Aboriginal analyst like myself is only able to get his hands on publicly available information. The ones, you know, people, my equivalents at the federal government, have access to the not-so-public information. And I think that's where they're, you know, basing a lot of these cuts on, as well as the timing. So the timing could not have been better. I mean, we just hit the end of the residential school application deadline. And right around the same time, the government takes the opportunity to announce these cuts. So now even our Aboriginal medias are struggling to balance both stories. You know, on the one hand, the residential school deadline coming up, and we're having to put all the kinds of resources into hoping to ensure that anybody who wanted to participate is able and knowledgeable that it's happening. At the same time, trying to make the general public aware of the funding cuts and what the potential effects are. So it's really just the perfect storm that you can't tell me is a coincidence, you know, like it's just the way it's
right.
happening is just
mm-hmm.
couldn't have been done any better. I mean, it's been completely orchestrated, you know, by the powers that be in such a way as to, I guess, avoid a massive public outrage on this. And then the very organizations who would be, you know, our elected leaders or those who are supposed to represent us or those who should be leading this outcry have now just been severely crippled. And it didn't just start, you know, in the past couple of months. I mean, the fact, in my opinion, that they were had become so dependent on these government dollars and are now basically treading water, trying to survive based on it, I think has really created the situation. So I think our voices had been quieted over the last 5 to 10 years by the constant funding, you know, the funding increases that you talk about. I mean, not just in government, but also in the First Nations NGOs. But then once the funding is cut, nobody knows what to do or what to say. You know, everybody wants to play nice, it seems, to try and reconvince, you know, governments to give it back. But that's never been my experience in the last, you know, 15, 20 years that when there's a cut that the money ever comes back. And I don't think that's really
yeah.
sunk in here yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not coming back. You're absolutely right. The programs that I've been noticing most of all the articles I've been reading on the research, it's mostly in the mental health and the healing. Now, let's talk about the mental health part of it. Why is there such a big need for funding for mental health in the Native communities?
I would have to say because of the effects of the residential school system. I think the intergenerational effects have not been very well documented. And in the residential school settlement process, one of the biggest complaints that people have, or that I've heard from our First Nations community all across the country, is that the children of the residential school survivors, who never went to residential school themselves, have been completely cut out of the entire process. So basically we get a situation like many people in my family, both my immediate family and my extended family, who suffer from the intergenerational effects of the residential school system. I mean, our parents were raised in institutions, right, incarcerated in institutions, and never learned appropriate parenting skills. So in a lot of cases, I mean, many of our people, I'd say the vast majority of our people, don't know how to relate to their children on a parent-to-child level. Growing up, I always saw many of my cousins and friends, they were treated by their parents as, almost like equals, like adult equals. I've seen people who get an equal share of their child tax, given to them, large quantities of money, portions of social assistance given directly to children. I could never really believe sometimes like how much cash money I would see some of my friends having. I mean, in some of the most impoverished communities, you hear about all the poverty, and then you see a very young kid, 7-8 years old, walking around with $50 bills, and it's squandered, right? I mean, that's why there's no building of wealth. There's no increase in infrastructure or assets in our community because most of the money is piddled away on useless things like junk food and stuff, which contributes to larger problems of diabetes and poor health and all those issues. In terms of the mental health,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
In terms of the mental health, what happened in the residential school settlement is that there was monies that were added, to the claims. In a specific claim, you'd be compensated for the abuse, the ongoing psychological harms that caused you up until the point of your hearing, as well as any loss of opportunity for education and employment. So that number was calculated. In addition to that number, if you were to develop what's called a future care plan or a healing plan in order to address the mental health issues produced by the experience of the residential school experience, they would add for traditional and psychological counseling an additional $10,000, which in most cases on average is about 10%. They're going to give you an extra 10% to kind of get yourself well. If you were willing to see a psychiatrist, they would go up to another $15,000. Now, none of this money was accountable. Basically, the money would just be added as a lump sum when a person received their settlement. So in most cases, people that receive a large sum of money and are told, "Oh, that includes your future care plan," there was no follow up. So even people that I've dealt with, they received their settlement, they went out there and did whatever they were going to do with their money. It's their legal right to spend their money as they see fit. And then, they come back saying, "Well, okay, wasn't I supposed to meet with that psychologist or psychiatrist?" And then usually I'll have to tell them, "Well, no, you were given the money to do that." Like the government of Canada, like the Adjudication Secretariat, is not phoning them to find out if they went and got their counseling, if they went and got their help. But statistically, the government of Canada is going to be able to show that they paid out that money and just assume that those people who needed that psychiatric help went and received it.
This is crazy because these are the same people that they say they must keep their land and their money in trust for because they're indigent. But we're going to give you 10, 20, 30,000. Well, it's not that much. 10, 13, 16,000.
10 to 15.
And tell you to go get your own counseling. Really, that's not going to work. No one saw that. You know what I'm saying?
Well, that's kind of the question I've been asking myself, since being in this for the last 3.5 years. It's kind of a little too perfect, you might say. It's just kind of happened a little bit too well.
We must hold their lands and their money in trust, but we're going to give them $15,000 and expect them to go get their own healing. We already know what they do with the money. It's just enough to put on one good drunk before they commit suicide. So that money is continuing the genocidal practices of the suppressing government, in my view. That's my view. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about healing some, because when we're talking healing, You know, as a First Nation person, I would think that my healing needs to be done traditionally within my culture.
Yes. Yep.
And that's where this funding's being cut from. It's not being cut from, well, it's really not funding, like you said. It's being given to them, and then they're calling for their help.
But it is kind of right there, black and white, in the policy that, you know, that the people
that.
Who wish for traditional healing are, you know, technically being discriminated against. Because just the policy that if you want to see an elder, they'll give you $10,000, but if you want to see a psychiatrist, they'll give you $15,000. You know, what does that tell you about the, you know, the viewpoint of the adjudication secretariat? If they're saying that a, you know, a non-native psychiatrist is worth $15,000, and a traditional elder, you know, people who've had this knowledge passed down for long before Sigmund Freud was ever born, before modern psychology was ever invented, you know, these practices have been helping people through their legitimate, you know, psychological or mental health needs, are basically being discriminated. They say that your way of healing people is only two-thirds as valuable as ours. You know, that's basically what we're being told in the policy.
You know, and then another thing, too, Frank, is when you're not going through native traditional healing and you're going through birth healing, I've read many articles, Frank, where this healing that you're supposed to go to is funded or administrated by the same churches who created the atrocities to begin with. So, Frank, I don't feel that I can heal with my rapist. What do I do now? You know what I'm saying?
Well, like what I've been seeing, you know, I have seen a lot of suicide, first off. So, I mean, that seems to be a prime you know, example. And a lot of abuse of substances, self-medication, and not just in terms of, you know, street drugs and alcohol, but also prescription drugs. I'd say the vast majority would be, you know, antidepressants and sedatives, and, you know, I've seen all kinds of new prescriptions through, you know, people I work with for things like, you know, Valium and Prozac. So, and I'm always kind of surprised by that, because basically it's kind of giving the money directly back, you know, to the to the perpetrator. Even in terms of having the policy favor psychiatric care, I mean, psychiatric care, in my opinion, almost always results in some prescription. To me, that's the big difference between a psychologist and a psychiatrist, is a psychiatrist can give you pills, you know. For favoring those ones, I mean, we're basically... We're basically, you know, kind of giving the advantage to those people who are going to be putting the money right back into the large pharmaceutical companies.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
So, and that's government orchestrated. You know, like, it's crazy.
Yeah. It's really crazy, because I'll tell you, when I'm hurting, I want to stop hurting now. You make a very good point there when you talk about the pharmaceuticals. You know, when that's what the alcohol comes in. So addictions come from the healing. Are trying to mask the hurt. You know, it is a vicious circle, and to me, and sounding to you with your speaking, it's plain to see. And if it's that plain to see, why isn't mainstream getting it?
Well, you know, I guess I guess it's plainer for us to see than the mainstream, unfortunately. You know, that's kind of a given. I guess because the line that we're getting from the government of Canada is that, oh, well, we're seeing to it that, you know, all these people who need help are being given the opportunity to get it, right? That I'd almost entirely have to disagree with. Like, in Canada, we're told that about 5 million people do not have access to a family doctor, okay? Almost 80% of those are First Nations people living in remote communities. Now, if they don't have access to a GP, like, a, you know, just a regular family doctor, I wonder how many First Nations people in this country actually have access to psychiatric care. You know, I haven't been able to find the numbers out there, and I would consider it fairly rare. I mean, the people that I've worked with, you know, approximately 5,000 survivors that I've, you know, talked to in the last 3.5 years, I would have to estimate that, you know, maybe 5% or less of them have received psychiatric care. And the ones that have, this is the amazing thing, the ones that actually have received psychiatric care almost entirely receive that care in the prison system. So really the only, you know, psychiatrists and psychologists that are generally available to First Nations people are usually in under incarceration. So that's kind of what we're being told, you know, if you need to get psychiatric care or you have mental health issues, you need to be reincarcerated in our new system of, you know, Aboriginal incarceration. So that to me, that just, you know, it's quite upsetting.
Do you believe there's any true healing
process
there? Do you believe there's any true healing there, even for the incarcerated?
No. No, I haven't seen it.
That money's being stolen, too. Yeah,
yeah. It's a way of basically siphoning that money back. And that's the biggest problem with a lot of these funding cuts is that there are health programs through organizations such as the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, such as the Assembly of First Nations, who are advocating to get access to these types of services to First Nations people, especially those, you know, living in remote communities. And now they're losing 80% of their capacity to do so. So to me, that kind of speaks volumes, you know, about what the plan is.
Yeah, you know, it's broken hearts, it's broken bones, it's broken promises, it's broken lives, is what it is. And then to get that, I want to stop hurting now, becomes the addiction of the drug and the alcohol. And when there's no more money for that drug and alcohol, and that fix to get fixed right now, then our nation start seeing high rises in violence. It is a perpetrated cycle that continues to deteriorate the culture and the communities of First Nations. You know, I don't know what the answer is. You know, I don't know how to be more of than just a voice. But I do know to speak truth and to speak clearly and bring it to the bottom line as simple as you can when you try to explain this, because my view on this is it gets by mainstream because the laws themselves are racist and they're brokered and not legislated into law. For a taxpayer to feel that I've helped that child, or I've helped that culture of people, regardless of what color your eyes is, comes from a superiority that we've done enough. And that kind of thinking comes from a government who breeds fake patriotism. You haven't done enough. And what you have done, you should have never done. All the healing, all the mental health, all the funding, all the food, all the education that any First Nation person or any person within Canada needs lies within the resources of that land. And that's what it was meant to be.
And you know, I think that's the problem. The problem is the perspective of, you know, the Canadian taxpayer is kind of backwards. They look at some of the issues in the Aboriginal community and they feel that, like, well, you know, I've made my income and paid my taxes. And my taxes are there to help these people. They're not seeing it the opposite way. The way I see it is that because of the Aboriginal people and the lands and resources that are inherently theirs through treaty right, I have earned my income. And I think that's a real major problem all across this country, is that it's an afterthought. It's coming out of my tax dollars, you know. But the true reality is the income that we should be based on this, and this isn't from me. This is, you know, Ovid Mekredi has, you know, touted this for the last 20 years. He said that the opportunities for funding to First Nations and First Nations organization should not be coming from the, you know, the general revenues of the Government of Canada. Like, we should not be a portion or percentage of the national budget. It should come instead from the production of this country, the gross national product, the gross domestic product. Those are the numbers that, you know, that funding should be based on. And that would create, you know, a true sense of self-government. Basically, to me, that would be paying your lease, paying your rent. You know, because, you know, we started seeing everything going on in the tar sands, all of the production going on all across this country. This comes from native land. You know, they've got even our own people convinced that our land is the reserve. Well, excuse me, our land is this turtle island. It's all of North America. You know, whether the U.S. government recognizes, whether it's the Mexican government recognizes it,
right.
This is what it is. We have the inherent, you know, right to this land as the original peoples of it. So it shouldn't be thought of as a secondary thought, like, okay, I pay my taxes are used to create these programs, right, which are now being cut, thank you very much, you know.
Yeah.
It should be seen the other way. Because of the First Nations people and the lands that they agreed to share with us under the treaty, not that we surrendered, not that we sold, we agreed to share with it, I am able to make my living. That should be the point of view of the Canadian taxpayer, and that's not what we're seeing.
Absolutely. Yeah. Very well said. Absolutely. And that's what infuriates me, to reach out and just want to strangle common sense back into society. That's it in a nutshell. I mean, I don't understand how – I'm a charitable person. I work in charity.
Mm-hmm.
I worked in charity for the last 15 years. I raise a lot of money. I take money from a community I live in, and I give it back to Indian country. So, and the organization that I'm involved in, Whisper and Thunder, a great team of people who continually raise money to put into Indian country. With that concept, I have to think that society is a compassionate heart, because the work that we do has been so amazing, and that comes from people of a society.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm really, really confused. It seems to me, in the education, we're not educating truth. In our school systems today, we're still representing a lie that these lands were discovered. On Monday here in the States, they're going to be celebrating Columbus Day,
mm-hmm.
a mass murder of people. They celebrate in this country. You know, so it skips to education. Education is what either dummies down a person or it brings them to a level of intelligence. And I think that if we started with the education and teaching truth of history instead of his story, I think then we'll see a change. But, Frank, even if they started that tomorrow, I don't think that we would see a change in our lifetime and probably not our children's either. Yeah.
Well, you know, that's kind of yet to be seen, really. I mean, we now that these funding cuts have been, I guess, announced or they're being made, and obviously our people aren't creating the kind of uproar that we would have expected, you know, when this happened.
Right.
I believe that many of the Aboriginal organizations are going to be forced to find alternative sources for their funding than the Government of Canada. And I think that's one of the main, you know, issues, is that we allowed ourselves to become too dependent on government funding in terms of our political advocacy. So, you know, so such as Whisper and Thunder and organizations like it, basically I think those our political organizations, you know, including the Assembly of First Nations, is going to have to take a look at that and say, well, how do these types of organizations operate and how are they able to do so independently? I mean, I guess that does come, you know, into my next thought is I started wondering, you know, like what will it look like if the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs and the Assembly of First Nations are forced to, you know, find their own sources of revenue. So I think the voice that we'll have representing us could be very different, you know, in the next 10 to 20 years if you know, the bills are being paid, you know, through grassroots funding sources. I think that's something that many of us will start having to look at, you know, that if we feel that we're being represented politically by a particular organization, you know, then we will have to kind of dig into our own pockets and make that contribution. That will create a much different face, you know, much different process for how we're going to see this. The political structure right now of many of these organizations is where, you know, the chiefs or elected chiefs get together and they vote for the representative. Well, if I'm going to be reaching into my own pocket to help pay the bills for one of these organizations, I'm not going to be doing so, you know, for somebody else to cast my vote. I'm going to want to vote myself, you know, so we may have to start looking at a grassroots process of electing our leaders. And so I think that, you know, people who, you know, at the grassroots, who if are able to, first of all, be elected, you know, that they're going to have a much different voice than maybe some of the people who have, you know, become very reliant on government funding sources over the last, you know, 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, I find it very hard for any native to say that they live a traditional life when they allow someone else to speak for them, because you know as well as I do that no one speaks for me, no one speaks for my community other than my community members. We all speak for each other. So how we tell into this system that one person speaks for us, especially from a people who were ruled by clans mothers and our speaker is a male. You know what I'm saying? So there's a lot of things that we can get into, but kind of going off track there. But as a native, we speak for ourselves. And I think when we get back to that kind of system, I think we'll start seeing that uproar that I was talking about. When people can finally start speaking for themselves, there's a lot of fear within First Nations, and I understand it. You know, when you speak the wrong way, your funding's cut from within your own community. You know, so there's that fear mongering that you were talking about, and it's perpetrated down in levels. You know, it's how they're ruled. They're going to rule theirs. You know what I mean? So it does exist. It does scare people. You know, so we're going to get into a little bit of that. But first, I want to throw you out a question, and then we're going to take a break here. And oh crap, that question just left my mind. Well, I did have a question for you. So you know what? We're going to take a break, Frank. We're going to play a song and try to come back with a more upbeat and what we should be doing and what we could be doing and moving forward. So with that, we're going to hear some Winds of Change.
Change flows straight into the face of time, like a
Productions. This is Fire Talk and your host today, Russ Letica. We've been speaking with Frank Bush about funding cuts connected to the residential school payouts. Frank, I remembered my question, and I guess when I said we're going to Winds of Change, we're going to go back to this question first.
Okay.
Frank, when you said earlier that it could take out up to 10 years for these settlements to pay out, which is going to be a very small percentage of the annual budget over the 10 years, so there's not a lot of loss to the government. What comes to mind, Frank, is elders. Elders who took themselves to the TRC. People of poverty who had to go hundreds of miles to get to this TRC to tell their truth. And those elders who were awarded the small amount of money that they were awarded, if it takes up to 10 years to pay him, Frank, is it the government's plan to let these people die before they're paid?
Well, certainly there does appear to be a motivation. As far as I can tell procedurally, in most cases, if a person, dies before they are able to have their story heard, at a hearing or, through the adjudication secretariat, most of the time procedurally their case basically dies with them. So for those people who were able to get an application into the Government of Canada before this recently passed deadline of September 19, 2012, their story is still on paper, but still no evidence has been produced. In order for information in this type of proceeding to be seen as evidence, it has to come from a person's lips. It has to come from basically an eyewitness testimony. I think under most circumstances, the way it looks is that, somebody wrote an application that somebody else signed off on. What does that mean? Under Canadian law, not really a lot. In order to produce evidence or, eyewitness testimony, you have to hear from the person directly, and the person's statement has to be, analyzed for credibility. And the way to do that is to ask for details of those questions. So, in the hearing process, a person tells their story, and then they're asked questions, details on it. So that's basically how an eyewitness testimony is produced, and that's what the residential school settlements are based on that person's credibility. So they actually, under the adjudication secretariat process, they are being, judged when they do tell their story about, how truthful does this seem, how much information are there. And, we pass through all these, you know, Western philosophical logic tests, like, well, how many people are saying this? It's not good enough for one person to say this person violated me, you know. It's you got to have 10 or 20 of them saying that, you know, this is the case. And so in different cases, I mean, you know, if you're naming a perpetrator who's been named many times, and you know, as you pointed out the last time I was on the show, I mean, these names are not being made public. They're being kept very private, you know, then even the survivor, when they name their perpetrator, has no idea whether or not this is, you know, a named person or a person who is known to the government of Canada as a, you know, a repeat offender, you know, of sexually or physically abusing children in the residential school system.
Yeah.
So, I, you know, it just kind of boggles the mind.
Yeah, it is boggling. Let's, I brought up a point. I brought up education.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe, and I'm sure you believe it, it stems in education, and we're already underfunded by billions of dollars annually in education.
Yes.
So, I mean, how do we fix that? What do we do?
Well, I guess first off, I'll tell you what we don't do is we don't cut 80% of the funding to regional organizations who assist in facilitating the process of educating our children. Something people don't really realize in Canada is that the education is a provincial jurisdiction. So for those you know, children and students who are living on reserve, their education is generally being you know, supplied or provided for by the you know, the Government of Canada through the Department of Indian Affairs. You know, now they're called the Aboriginal Affairs and Northern Development Canada. I'll still always remember them forever and for always as Indian Affairs. But they're the ones who are providing the funding. And a lot of the, I guess, developments and advocacy for equality with the provincial system, the public school system in Canada, is provided for by organizations like the Assembly of First Nations and the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. And so by crippling those organizations, we're not taking any steps closer to, you know, to parity with the public school system. We're taking a giant step backwards. You know, a lot of these people who are working in that field are now going to be having to seek employment elsewhere, possibly in other fields. That's going to be the most difficult process, you know, and it's an issue that's kind of near and dear to my heart. Like, my mother was a teacher, and my sister is also a teacher, you know, in the Aboriginal community. So I kind of am very concerned about a lot of our educators and education professionals, you know, because these are the types of services that will have to be eliminated, you know, under these new budget guidelines. And it's just crazy to think that it's because of the residential school system and the, you know, the residential school settlement process that this is being allowed to be facilitated. That, you know,
right,
compensation for the old education system, which we know to be wrong, an act of genocide, is being used as justification for further distancing our First Nations children from a proper education.
Yep.
You know, and that's what the public isn't seeing. Like, both the mainstream public and our First Nations people aren't seeing this, and they won't see it until, you know, the statistics come out, you know, 4 or 5 years from now, that this has been the effect. Right now, we're in the middle of what Calvin Helin calls the demographic tsunami. I mean, we have, you know, this baby boom going on in the Aboriginal community, and really it's kind of a resurgence or rebirth of our populations. You know, at one time, it's estimated that there were 22 million First Nations people on Turtle Island. A devastating 95% of those people were killed off through, you know, either the Spanish conquest, but mostly through epidemic diseases, you know, at the, yeah, you know, in the, between 1500 to 1700. So we're talking about 18 to 19 million people who died in Canada. They're, you know, still fairly rare when you look at the national body, you know, hovering, you know, in the just over 1 million range. I mean, you know, as our population naturally begins to rebuild itself, the population, you know, the funding or the services, public services that, you know, in this country we call mandatory, we call, you know, a human right, are being reduced, you know, and that, to me, that just doesn't make any sense because, you know, while Aboriginal professionals such as myself, such as my sister, are out there trying to improve opportunities for First Nations children, those opportunities are now being removed, you know. And I think I can take, like you, I kind of work in the corporate world, so I'm able to take, a kind of heavier hand to it, you might say, or, a different look at it because, my livelihood is not at stake here. But for those people out there listening who are in that situation, you know, I really feel for them because, I mean, all their lives or, at least in their professional lives, they've been out there trying to make, the country a better place for our First Nations people, especially elders and children. And now they're sitting there wondering if they're going to have a job come the new year. That's a very difficult position for, our best and brightest to be in. But that's exactly, what the reality is on the street for many of these people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're definitely taking a big step backwards here where we should be trying to move forward, trying to stem the flow of this, demographic tsunami. Right now, it's estimated that just over 50% of the Aboriginal community in Canada is under the age of 25. Many of our military scholars here in Canada, such as Douglas Bland and such as Senator one of my favorite authors, and now his name is Romeo Dallaire, has basically stated that in any parts of the world where there's been a major conflict of Indigenous populations against the colonizer, this has been the fertile grounds in which those seeds grow, where there's a large disenfranchised portion of the population, without education, without employment, who are struggling in the peripheries of our society, who eventually rebel, and that's not being really considered, in this process. It's those people who work in many of these organizations who are trying to stem the tide. The best example I can give you, years ago I was talking to one of the band counselors from Sandy Bay First Nation here in Manitoba, and he told me, we have 6 graduates from our on-reserve high school this year. He goes, but we had 200 registrations for kindergarten. And I said, that must be the big dropout rate in that, eh? He goes, well, the dropout rate is 50%. So if, the people who might have dropped out had stayed, we'd still only have 12 graduates. The demographic tsunami is coming, and people in this country aren't really realizing it, and it's more of our mainstream political, organizations and people become disenfranchised. I mean, it's just creating this sweltering storm that, myself included, people who, advocate for peace would much rather like to avoid, there are those elements out there who would like to see something very different happen. But, it's almost like their hands are going to be forced in this situation, right? That, that we're not able to provide the, mandatory or, services or what we call human rights in this country to people who most desperately need it. I mean, it's going to create a much bigger animal.
Mm-hmm. Clint, in the picture that's being drawn clearer and clearer of the connection between these cuts and residential schools, you threw out some numbers on the last show. I'm not for sure what they are. I'm going to throw them out and get my question out, and then you correct me. I think the numbers where you threw out that there was 150,000 people who actually went through the TRC, but there was actually 300 and something thousand that actually put a claim to it, and a large number, more than 50%, were not eligible for claims. Now, with what we see in the funding cut today, if all those people were eligible, where would we be sitting today? 0% cut? I mean, would it be 100% cut? They wouldn't be able to make a profit. So it almost feels like those people that you told us that they cut was for this plan that we're talking now over this 10-year period where they'll actually make a profit off it.
Yes.
So what were those numbers?
Okay, well, there's been, to date, there's been, well, not to date, but as of August 31st, there has been just shy of 30,000 applications to the independent assessment process. The government numbers that were out there were that there was approximately 150,000 people that went through the residential school system as they define it. So, the government currently recognizes 138 residential schools across Canada. Many of the schools that that were asked to be added were eliminated. Originally, I believe the number was about 650 schools. So to me, if 138 schools made up 150,000 people, if you quadruple that number, it's more likely that 600,000 people went through the government process of assimilation that was facilitated through either the residential school system, the day school system, or other like-minded institutions. And I would have to throw the child and family services system into that number. Definitely government procedures such as the 60s and 70s SCOOP would be involved in that. All told, all together, I would say that well over 500,000 First Nations people in Canada were directly affected by this process, right? And those are the only people anybody's looking at. They're not talking about people like myself who were indirectly affected through the intergenerational effect of the school. But basically, just based on those numbers alone, we had 30,000 people who have applied. So far, 2,500 people actually were denied. So if you can imagine, they went to the hearing process. They went through a 2 or 3 year research and documentation collection process before being able to go into a hearing. And then they went to a hearing, they told their story, of abuse, of rape, of, watching friends and family members being murdered in the residential school system. And then we're told, sorry, the experience that you've told us about is not eligible for compensation under this process.
So
2,500
no psychological healing there for that survivor, right? So there's no psychological healing there for that one, huh?
No, it actually is more like it's more damaging, really. So, and then they're told they're referred to, government services currently available through Health Canada and other organizations. And then one thing I'd like to look at is what the life expectancy is for those people, because I'm sure it's vastly shortened as a result of that experience. Including those people, the people who are actually being paid out, over a 10-year process, we're looking. The government is supposed to be paying out $4.6 billion. That's yet to be seen. To date, they paid out, I believe it was $1.6 billion that was paid out through the common experience process, and so far about $1.686 billion. So about the same amount that has been paid out so far through, the hearing process. So all told together, you're looking at about $3.2 billion paid out over so far, about the last 7 years. The common experience payment process started before the hearing process has started.
Right, yeah.
So if we were to estimate 10 years for the entire settlement to be paid out, you'd be looking at about $460 million a year, which would comprise, on average, only 0.17% of the overall Canadian budget. So the entire government of Canada looking at that number. So my big concern is when they started talking about these cuts, and this is, I guess, the big linkage that we're talking about that no one's really taking into consideration. In 2006, the annual budget for Indian Affairs was $6.9 billion. So about $6.9 billion is earmarked towards Aboriginal programming. Now, it's a whole nother, show, to talk about how much of that $6.9 billion is actually making its way to the First Nation.
Because most of it is filtered
out through, through the salaries and expenditures of the Department of Indian Affairs. So we don't know exactly how much of that money. If we take this at face value, if we say, okay, so there's $6.9 billion a year being spent on First Nations people every year by the government, then if they were to reduce the services by only 10%, so if they're able to, across the board, as they say, reduce it by 10%, which I'm not sure if that's, probable or possible, but anyway, by 10%, the government's going to save $690 million per year. So that's their savings. Now, what they're spending on the residential school settlement works out to, on average, $460 million. That means as of next year, the government will have made a $230 million profit on, what they call the Indian problem. So once the settlement process is actually completed in 5 years, they'll be able, if it's maintained, they'll be able to keep that whole $690 million. So that means that, the government's going to save approximately, they're going to be able to recover about $1.15 billion over the next 5 years, of the $4.6 billion. They'll break even about 5 years later. So based on my estimates, it'll be about by 2022, the government will start making a profit you know, a significant profit on having not only paid out the residential school settlements, but all, and then using that as justification for cutting, you know, Aboriginal programming. Now, that's based on a 10% reduction in Indian Affairs. Now, like I said, in some cases, especially in terms of the Assembly of Manitoba chiefs, which is, I guess, my example here in the province of Manitoba, they're losing 80% of their funding. So I think that's you know, that's the thing that I'll be calculating at the end of the year, you know, with the numbers are put out. And, of course, I've got to take the government's word for it. You know, it's the government auditors and the, you know, the auditor general that's going to put out these numbers as to how much money was actually spent. Then I'll actually be able to look at, okay, what was the true reduction? So, I mean, if the reduction was actually 20%, 20% reduction to Indian Affairs, well, in that case, you'd be looking at closer to 1.3 billion per year. So in that model, they'd actually break even in about 3 years and start making a profit after five. So, I mean, this is, you know, to me, this is kind of a, it's almost like it's been an investment on the part of the government. You know, we create this big media frenzy about the residential school settlements and all the healing work that's going on and, you know, all the... Yes, basically that's what they're doing. We get the Canadian public or Canadian mainstream on our side, back on our side. Because prior to the residential school settlement, you know, process, mainstream Canada was starting to side with the First Nations people. I mean, we were getting more and more allies in the non-Native community, you know, who started learning the truth of history, who started seeing that, yes, you know, my income, whether I be a farmer, whether I be working in the oil patch, whether I be providing any kind of product or service in this country, stems from the lands and resources of the original peoples of Turtle Island.
Yeah.
So people were starting to see that. And you know, and to me, it's almost like, you know, the government saw this and they said, okay, well, if we invest a bunch of money up front, which is taxpayers' dollars anyway, it's not, you know, it's not anything that's any skin off their teeth. We can put a bunch of money forward, make big announcements, get, you know, the average Canadian back on our side and be making a profit inside of 12 years. Well, you know, that's just a little bit too, you know, a little bit too, I guess, you know, much of a coincidence for me to swallow outright.
And that's why I say that apology was forced, because it was an apology for profit. That was
a
true apology, because we already established that apology doesn't come by words, it comes by actions. And the actions,
and these
that
are the actions we're seeing.
Apology have been atrocious. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've traveled through a lot of First Nations in your profession, and you're involved with the payouts of the residential schools and overlooking that, and I thank you for that. You've been to a lot of our nations. How many of those nations are self-sufficient?
I'd have to say very few in terms of percentage.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to some real good models. I've been out to the Isuyas Indian Band. I've been out to West Bank First Nation. I've been out to Musqueam and Tsleil-Waututh and many of the, you know, very, you know, economically strong First Nations in the southern British Columbia area. And I think those are the examples that are usually touted as you know, as a model for what the, you know, First Nations could look like. Now, I do have to say that although those models and those examples are really great and very inspiring, and I mean, they've been so for me, the vast majority of the communities I've been to live in unimaginable poverty. Including my own First Nation, the Opipanipewin First Nation, in one of the poorest Aboriginal communities in Manitoba. Now, Manitoba, I'd have to say, I'd have a fight on my hands if I said this to somebody from Saskatchewan, but I'd have to say that Manitoba, in terms of Aboriginal, you know, issues, is the most impoverished province or area in this country. To compare, you couldn't compare, I guess, most of the First Nations, like 90% of the First Nations of Manitoba, to even half the First Nations in British Columbia. You know, it's a much different animal.
Right.
I've been up and down the oil patch in Alberta and Saskatchewan, and I've seen, you know, those First Nations that are able to, I guess, you know, benefit in some way financially from the resource of oil that's beneath their lands or, you know, available to them. Mm-hmm. And some of those stories are quite inspiring, and some of those are you know, a whole other matter. I've been out to one particular First Nation that is very wealthy in terms of the of, I guess, oil developments and oil royalties. But to me, socially, the money has done nothing for them. They have all the same, you know, problems of drug, alcohol, violence, sexual violence on the First Nation as any of the impoverished ones. You know, and I found that very surprising and shocking. You know, like I assumed, oh, these guys are getting millions and millions and millions of dollars every year from oil revenues. And then you come and you see gangs, you see drive-by shootings, you see mass alcoholism. And, you know what is, it's hard to say, well, what is the cause and effect?
I have to say that that's bad management. And I'll tell you why I say that. Because I'm from the Madawaska Maliseet. As you know, we're building our economic plan now. We're not self-sufficient people, but we will be. But we will be. And I'm going to tell you, from the root of this plan, all the way up into our infrastructure in and groundbreaking, and 26 businesses, one being a truck stop, coming in to support my community of 354 people. From the very root of this idea to do this economic plan was to become self-sufficient so that we could reach out to build other nations. So these ones that you've seen, especially the one you're talking about with the oil royalties, I have to say that they've assimilated to the greed. Because there's no way that I could sleep in my comfortable bed with 300 cotton sheets knowing that my brothers and sisters of another nation are sleeping on the dirt floor. So I have to say that we need to look within our own nations, the one that have, the very few that have, and we have to reach their compassionate charity. Because these are nations who have made corporations, and out of those corporations, we need your help because we're not getting it from the government. So it is imperative for our First Nations to become self-sufficient through economic development. But what's more important than that is the ones who finally succeed to reach down and pick up your brother and pick up your sister. Because I believe that's our way out of this. There's no golden key. There's no golden ticket. We're still fighting 500 years later. But I think we've lost the path on what we're fighting for. Because when you hear of nations who are doing well, but the social structure of it hasn't changed, you know, I shake my head and I wonder how the imagery of those people can be used to make a profit. You know, casinos, I'm 50-50 on them. If that casino was supporting a community, I'm all for it. I know with those slot machines come alcohol because that's how it's set up. I'm all for it. The money that my nation has made on the casino in the last 3 years employs a doctor within our own community and a nurse 4 days a week. So I see the good that this casino money is doing. But we have nations with casinos that have sold out to white corporate. And these are white corporate casinos now, making money off the imagery. So when you hear about this economic stuff happening in Indian country, we have to look at the management of it. Because it's within that management that more money is being stolen from us by using the imagery of us. So I would hope that any nation reaching for economic development, self-sufficiency, is also thinking about the nation next to them. And we build ourselves one at a time until we stand equally once again. That's what I think moving forward is about. That education, of course, you know. So, I mean, it's a beautiful thought. How do we implement it? You know?
Well, you know, that's the flip side of these funding cuts to our Aboriginal organizations is that yes, they are gonna be forced to find sources of revenue elsewhere. And with that, and it's my hope that alternate source of revenue will come from economic development. It's only through Aboriginal economic development that our people will ever, be able to have a sustainable and viable system of self-government. We can never base a self-government model when somebody else is footing the bill. So no matter how we say, you know, like it's owed, it's like a rental being paid, until we're, earning it for ourselves, our communities won't have the sense of pride that comes with accomplishment. I think that's the biggest concern that I've seen in the community, you know, and I talk to youth and that, and, you know, I always kind of, I encourage them to learn the trades and that, to seek higher learning, seek
Absolutely.
Education, you know, somewhere where, you know, that their own efforts can result in them independently, you know, making their own way, you know, without assistance from government. Because even in a self-governing system, you know, it would be a full-time struggle for many of our nations to be able to support the type of system that's been created on many of our First Nations, where there's, you know, my home community, you know, is in the neighborhood of 80% dependent on social assistance. To me, that's kind of catastrophic. If my nation were to be able to become self-governing, you know, it'd be a full-time job to try and support that many people. So I really think it needs to come from the grassroots. Each person has to decide for themselves that they wish to be, you know, economically self-sufficient. And then, you know, I think it'll be built from the ground up. So it starts with individuals, you know, such as myself and like yourself, and sharing that information. I mean, you know, you can't give a man a fish. And that's what our current system of governance has been completely built on. You know, right from, you know, the day the treaties were signed. I mean, that was the idea. Well, give them a fish, and they'll forget how to fish. And it's very disturbing to me to see how many of our people forgot how to fish. You know, and I think that's kind of what I try to teach people or learn, is that there are ways, there are alternatives to, you know, seeking funding from government. I mean, you don't have to, you know, convince any First Nations person that the money is owed. You know, it's like preaching to the choir. Everybody knows it, but is that what we really want to base it on? You know, so certain tribes, you know, such as the Osuyas Indian Band, began to reject government funding. You know, they were able to find their own revenue streams, find their own revenue sources, you know, because with the money is a poison pill. And, you know, I'm hoping people, you know, with the end of the residential school settlement process will start to see that. I mean, $4.6 billion, you know, in terms of the way it basically was per capita distributions. Right, it's given to the you know, the poorest of the most poor group in Canada. Even regular working class, you know, middle class people in Canada of whatever ethnicity, there's an amazing statistic out there about if they won the lottery, they would be bankrupt in 5 years. 85% of all lottery millionaires in the Canada and the U.S. are bankrupt within 5 years. Okay, so knowing that information, I mean, people need to realize that it's not about the money. It's about a person's ability to be independent, you know, and that's what we're missing. And, you know, Calvin Helin has written a wonderful book called The Empowerment Mindset. I'm a big fan of Calvin Helin. To me, it was a book that set me free, Dances with Dependency. And it talked about how our people have become so dependent on, you know, government sources of income and on corporate and, you know, municipal welfare systems, you know, that we forgot how to take care of ourselves. And, you know, there is kind of a growing movement in the grassroots of people who are rejecting it. They say, you know, like, I'm concerned about where my income comes from. I guarantee you that people who are currently being laid off of our national and regional political organizations never really stopped to think about where the money was coming from. You know, they never said, like, okay, well, the government gives us our money, and could anything ever happen to that? Right? It wasn't really taken into consideration. And, you know, I don't want to blame the victim. I don't want to kick a guy who was down. But I after reading Calvin Helin's book, The Dance of Dependency, I started thinking about that, because I was working in the First Nations community. I was working for nonprofit organizations, and that's exactly the thought I had back in 2006. I decided, you know, I don't control the government of Canada, and I'd rather they didn't control me. So I went into the private sector. You know, I had to learn my trade. I'm an accountant by trade, and you know, started seeking. Okay, I want to know where the money's coming from. So I did go a little corporate, and, you know, and I was accused a lot of times of being assimilated. And to me, I think there's nothing more traditional than someone who's able to go out, you know, get their own resources and come home and, you know, feed their family. And that's not what's being going on. When I go into the north, you know, northern Ontario, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan, you know, this is the attitude I get, you know, that it's a treaty right to welfare. You know, and they don't see it as a poison pill. And that's how I've come to see it, you know, being involved in the residential school settlement process and with First Nations organization, I see it as a poison pill now.
Well, that's like, you know, that's part of the intergenerational trauma, though. I mean, they starved our ancestry to put them on reserves and reservations. they've always used food and commodities and things of that nature to control. And, you know, it's just passed down from generation to generation. You know, but you make a very good point. You think so it is your treaty right to wealth, right? You know, I don't mean to brag on my nation or anything, but I can throw you some numbers to my nation. We have a 0% dropout rate.
Wow.
We have less than 3% on welfare. We're only talking 354 people within my community. You know, but even in those numbers, that's very impressive. It's in your leadership. It's in the education. We must educate our children today to become our leaders for the future. So although we want that child to become educated and go out and learn in whatever path they choose to take, but we would also like for those children to come home, because we need that education back within our communities to build them back up. You know, so we never want to take the path of our child or of our descendants, but the hope would be to come back home one day to use your education within the community. I do believe change comes within us. We are the answer to our own questions. We need to wake up. We need to become creative. And we need to start working towards self-sufficiency. It doesn't happen on how you expressed it. I agree with you that welfare is a treaty right. That is a major problem within our communities today.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So there's a lot of work, and each nation is unique in its own problems and solutions. There's not one answer across the board. You know that as well as I do. You've been to a lot of First Nations. You see the issues firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, we've been separated and twisted and turned, and people like yourself, me, and many others out there see the picture. And I just shake my head, Frank, because I don't know what more to say or do to get people to start following you by your actions, by doing good with your hands. So I don't know where to go. I mean, it's almost like a dead end. So I understand the frustration, and I don't live on reserve, and I see
mm-hmm.
this. So I already understand the frustration on within your community of the nation. You know, so I mean, it is mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I that's the thing that people have really lost touch with, is that you know, in terms of our ancestors and how they used to address problems. And I think that's part of the cultural genocide, which has caused this situation where, you know, we forgot how, you know, we as a people deal with you know, various problems as they come up. I think there's this thinking in the Aboriginal community that our ancestors never had any problems, that they lived in this pure utopia in which, you know, nobody ever died or nobody ever went hungry, but that's just not the case. I mean, you know, the story of our ancestors is a story of the struggle for survival against, you know, insurmountable odds. And, you know, one thing I could share with our listeners is the way our, you know, when our people started, you know, when we first started forming our clan system and we first started, you know, our system of traditional laws, we looked at the animals. We looked at our animal brothers and sisters to see how they were doing things. Our family unit and the clan structure came from our observation of wolves and, you know, the way the packs work. You know, the wolves have, you know, the alpha male and the alpha female as the head of the household, you know, married couple, basically, you might say. And, you know, they had a structure where the strong supported the not so strong. And that's kind of what we've lost here, you know, in our communities. You know, that's it's all a scramble, you know, people fighting for the scraps, you know, that come out of the band office. We need to change that. We need to take a step back. To me, in terms of parenting, I think is going to be a big key, especially for those people who went through the residential school system or through the intergenerational effect were affected by the residential school system. Every animal you observe in nature has kind of one mission in terms of their children, is to prepare that child to be independent, to become like a functioning adult of whatever nature, whether it's an eagle, whether it's a bear, whether it's a wolf. That is a parent's function, to make your child independent. I've seen in communities where, you know, the march to the welfare office is treated like a graduation ceremony. It's almost become a rite of passage in some of our northern communities. You know, for myself, you know, the very thought of taking my son to a welfare office, you know, it's just not something that, you know, I can, you know, naturally struggle with, but it's a reality for many people in our community. So we need to start looking at how it is, you know, even if those of us who aren't able to provide for ourselves, we needed to make it our, you know, ambition in life to make sure that, you know, our children don't go down the same path as us. You know, that we're able to teach our children to provide for themselves. And that does come from education. You know, I see a lot of communities where because people went through the residential school system, they don't put the same pressure on their children to attend school. You know, because they think, you know, their kid comes home and says, the teacher was mean to me. Well, you know, when you say that to a residential school survivor, the survivor is thinking a much different thing. They're thinking, were you physically abused? Were you sexually abused? You know, that's what the survivor is thinking. And, you know, after 50 years of being beaten down in the residential school system, I mean, their thought is not to go and defend their child. You know, the thought is to hide. You know, that's what they were taught.
Right.
You know, you avoid abuse by hiding, by not being noticed, by becoming invisible. You know, that is the tricks that we were taught in the residential school system. You know, you saw the abuse all around you, and as long as you were standing behind somebody else, it wouldn't be you. And that's kind of what's taken over in our First Nations communities, you know, where people have adopted this mentality of, well, let's just hide or let's not, you know, our children not. So many of the northern communities, I mean, you look at the attendance, you know, of children in just the public school on the reserve, and it's devastating. You know, you see a lot of children who have, like, only 20 to 30% classroom attendance. You know, and you wouldn't see this in the public school system because the public school system is funded based on attendance. So there's a lot more encouragement for the staff and for the family, you know, to ensure that the children are attending classes. Maybe our First Nations are going to be forced into a very similar situation where only the children, you know, who are attending school will receive education. You know, which is basically what's happening now. But if the funding goes down that route, our hands may be forced in that direction, where we'll have to start providing or supplying teachers supplies only for the amount of students that we could reasonably expect to be attending schools. So I mean, but you know, my problem with that is that it is beginning to create a class system within the Aboriginal community. You know, we now have, you know, middle class and lower class First Nations people. I haven't seen a whole lot of upper class Indians just yet, but I'm sure it's on the way.
I've seen a few.
Oh, you've seen a few. Okay. So I mean, it is happening, and that's never what our communities were supposed to be about. Our communities were, you know, under the clan system, all about equality, and we're losing that. It's being taken from us, and you know, we need to kind of do restoration. I guess what we're losing here is that the people are seeing, you know, the function of our Aboriginal communities in a much different light. You know, they believe, and I've been told this many times, you know, that if you earn your income in a certain way, then you've assimilated, right? Well, first we got to all look at our communities and realize, no, we've all been assimilated. You know, there's no traditional structure left on the First Nation. The reserve system is a failed system. And we need to get out of the mindset that our land is the reserve. You know, that's to me the biggest problem. The way I tell people, my grandfather's trap line is not located on my reserve, right? So those are the lands and resources that we've been using. Those are our rightful territories, not just what we've, you know, the Indian agent drew a circle around where we were standing, and that's our land now. We have to start seeing the entire country of Canada as being our land. You know, but we've been taught, and this through the residential school system, through assimilation, that our land is the reserve, and that's just not the case. You know, like maybe that we can use that as a base of operations to start expanding, but we have to stop seeing our land, you know, our lands as being limited to the reserve. That's I guess the system that the government of Canada and the government of the United States has created for us, not one that was originally. We need to start seeing this entire land as our land and start treating it as such. So if a person leaves the reserve in order to find employment, they got to stop feeling like and being treated like they've left their land. So, you know, and that's you don't have to have, in this day and age, we don't need to limit what we consider our community to these reserve lands. That is what the non-native government wishes for us. And we've been, you know, just blindly like sheep, just crawling right into that mentality. And it needs to stop at a grassroots level. We need to start seeing, you know, ourselves as the, you know, the inherent people of this land. We were the ones who, you know, Creator chose this land for. He made this land for us, and we need to start seeing that. I'm all for sharing this land with our, you know, non-Native brothers and sisters, but within reason.
Absolutely.
Sharing is not about, you know, us being forced onto a reserve while they reap the benefits of Creator's blessing for us. So, you know, it's going to be a definite have to be a change to the mindset we've developed. The problem is that the people now consider the colonial mindset to be tradition. You know, so I'm told I'm not traditional because I'm not on the reserve collecting social assistance. Well, I mean, I really have to stifle a laugh when somebody on the reserve says something like that to me. And I'm like, no, don't you understand? I am living the traditional life here. I've gone out to provide for my family. That is the, you know, that is the essence of my, you know, hunting and fishing community. You know, if the hunting and fishing isn't good in some area, well, the Creator gave me a lot of land and I move on. You know, and I think people voted with their feet here in Manitoba. About 75% of the First Nations people live off reserve. And any of the ones that I run into in the cities and where I work, I mean, they don't consider themselves any less traditional. They don't consider themselves assimilated. They're doing what is very natural to any animal on this planet. They're going where they're able to provide for their families. So it needs to start at that level. Right now, it's such a top-down approach. It's chief and council and, you know, and then the people. It was never that way. It was always the people and then the leaders.
Right.
So, I mean, we need to get back to our, you know, the real truth of our traditional ways and the ways of our ancestors. Observe the animals and replicate that within, you know, the space and, you know, knowledge that we've been given. So
right.
I still haven't... I've never met a First Nations person who is willing to give up their cell phone, you know, so I don't see anybody kind of, you know, crawling back into the bush. I don't see that happening. So I'm hoping that people start seeing for what it is that they can earn their own income without being considered, you know, a sellout or an apple or something like that, right? So.
Well, I'm not reserve born. I'm born here in the States. That's my reserve is in my communities in Canada, our territorial land. That we live on that's unceded. I want to throw that in there. So I understand what you're saying. But and as I said earlier, would never want to take anyone from their path that they're supposed to follow. And I think you said it eloquently when you said you are being traditional. You have moved on. You've moved to where you feed your family. You're absolutely right. But I do understand the concern within First Nations. I'm hearing you because I'm you. You know what I'm saying? So I do understand the concern, though, and I do see a problem if everyone decided to leave. So I know that's not feasible. It's not going to happen. We have elders, you know, and all that. So I know that's not feasible. But I think that we need to start looking at a time, too, when there's not enough natives, so they come in and they start taking pieces of land back. Or a nation who no longer marries within themselves and all have married out. You're no longer, you're like a Métis now. You're not really native now, are you? So that scares me to think that that's in the plan, because I truly believe that that is in the future plan. As we produce descendants, so does the crown. And that land is crown land held in trust. You own the first 2 inches of it. So it scares me to think of our nations, and I understand the need for youth to get out in this world. I do understand it, but it scares me when it all begins to happen and they all get that perception that that land is no longer needed and it's no longer a First Nation and it's no longer Native territory. It's now ceded and taken. You know, do you have concerns with that, or have you heard any views on that?
You know what? I'm not at all concerned about that because you know, like as we know, like I said before, our population is growing at 6 times the national average. Our land is not. You know, this reserve land is not growing at 6 times the rate. In fact, it's shrinking.
In
most cases.
I think so. Make a very good point.
So I'm not worried about everybody leaving. I'm worried that right now we have the housing crisis, where basically there's not enough room, there's not enough roofs to put over everybody's head. So unfortunately, a large portion of people are going to have to leave the reserve. Like, that's just reasonable. Like, I recently talked to a lady. She phoned my law office here, and she said, you know what, the chief and council won't give me a house. And I've been on this waiting list for, 4 or 5 years now. And she said, and I think it's because I'm from off reserve, and my husband is a band member. And I told her, I said, okay, well, you got to look at it this way. I said, how many houses were built on your community this year? And she said, oh yeah, there was this big funding announcement or whatever, and that they were going to build 5 houses. I said, okay, now do you know how many houses were, burned down or declared, unfit to live in this year? And then she really stopped for a minute there, and she goes, well, I know there's been at least 4 fires. And I said, okay, well, if you've had 4 fires, I'm going to guess that at least another 3 houses were probably condemned on your community.
Right.
So I said, so your chief and council has built 5 new houses with the funding that they're allocated, which, as we know from the theme of the show, that it's been cut,
Yeah.
And I said, your chief and council is actually now down 2 houses. They're not up any houses, so it's like they don't have any houses to give you. Even though it's a treaty right, I mean, in the treaties it states that the Crown will provide a dwelling for each native family. I mean, that's a treaty right, which, by the example of Attawapiskat, has not been fulfilled, obviously, but it's something that's diminishing. So growing at 6 times the rate of the national average, I basically explained to her, like, look, there's more people in your community, like, turning 18 now, like, possibly 6 times as many as there were 10 years ago.
Right.
So I said, so you're basically on this waiting list. It doesn't matter how long you're on the waiting list, because the waiting list is not coming down, it's growing. So this year alone, 2 new people, were added to the waiting list who already had houses. They're back in line. So my advice to her, I said, you need to seek gainful employment and find some opportunity. If you wish to live on the reserve, you laws need to be created or changed, as some of the successful First Nations we talked about were, where it guarantees the rights of the individual First Nations person in order to, build on the reserve land. I was recently asked by my chief and council to, come home and to build a home on the reserve. And I said, well, that's all well and good, but what will be my property rights? And unfortunately, they weren't really to prove, oh, we'll give you a certificate of possession and all this. I said, well, a certificate of possession under Canadian law can be overturned by chief and council. So, I would come to the reserve, build a house, and I could get a letter in the mail saying, okay, get out, you're no longer welcome. Even as a band member, I just don't have the rights. Except for those First Nations who've, signed into the First Nations Land Management Act, where they have, guaranteed property rights for individuals. But in most First Nations, we don't have that, and maybe a whole other subject. But that's the reality, is that, based on current funding levels and abilities of communities to, maintain housing and that, the reality is that if we want more houses on the reserve, we're going to have to build them ourselves. And in order for people to be motivated to build houses on reserve and to have mortgages and whatnot on reserve, they're going to have to feel secure, that they're not just going to be, shoved out by chief and council, which, is a common story on the First Nation today. There's an election and people get letters saying, please vacate this home. It's owned by the First Nation and not by you, so get out because I want to put my cousin or so-and-so in it. And this type of situation is going to be exacerbated. By the funding cuts that are coming, right? So I think that's what we're going to see. And this is the worst part of these funding cuts, is that the people who are going to have to bear the brunt of the effects are not going to be, the government bureaucrats and technocrats in Ottawa who with the stroke of a pen caused them. It's going to be our First Nations leadership. So First Nations people are going to be losing faith in their duly elected leaders because of the effect that they're going to see on the ground. So it hasn't been equated, and it's very difficult to explain to individual band members that, the stuff you see in the news, it comes out 3 or 4 years later as something significant like this. So this individual who I was talking to, she blamed her chief and council for the funding, the housing situation on her reserve. And so as kindly as I could, I tried to explain to her, and now I'm not the best explainer in the world, right? I get a little technical
at
times.
Pretty well right there.
I'm getting better, I guess so. But,
thanks for practicing on us.
So I must have learned, eh? So, But yeah, no, that's the reality of the situation, you know, is that the services that are being provided, that, you know, generally the funding comes from Ottawa to the First Nation and services are provided at that level. Now we're being told that that funding is being reduced significantly. So the need is growing and the resources are diminishing. That creates a major intersection of a problem. And the result is going to be more people leaving the First Nation. And right now they have no choice. My big concern, you know, day to day is, you know, just the stage of life I'm at. I have to see the immediate needs of people being met. So right now in my community, the city of Winnipeg, there are hundreds of children each night in the care of Child and Family Services who are being held in hotel rooms because they have no place for them, right? And, you know, and this is really going to grow as families lose their homes. I mean, it contributes to the breakdown of the family unit, more children in care, you know, more money for social workers and government technocrats and bureaucrats because now they have higher caseloads. The financial incentive for people who provide these emergency services is to reduce the services that are being provided by First Nations organizations. So that's all I can look at. I can only ever look at where is the money coming from. I'm an accountant. You know, like I said, I'm an accountant by trade, and I look at what is the effect. So when we announce these funding cuts and whatnot, this is the effect. And also I look at the incentive. What is the incentive of cutting the funding? Well, it increases money to our, you know, our friends in the government, and it decreases the ability of First Nations leaders to provide for their people.
Right.
Well, I tell you,
you explained that eloquently to me, and I think you should keep talking. We blew through another 2 hours, Frank, and you're right. There's so much more to talk about. We would love to have you back at the end of the year, beginning of the year, when these numbers fall.
Mm-hmm.
You are the accountant.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like firsthand. We would like, from the numbers that they're going to project, you come back and let's talk about those numbers, and let's bring this into another show. Frank, once again, amazing. Thank you so much. Your knowledge is tremendous. I connect with you. I mean, I see the picture and I speak in one way. You see the picture and you come with facts and numbers. And you know what? That there is the implementation of planting the seed.
For sure.
We've already begun by talking about it. You know, keep talking, brother. You keep talking and you come back and see us soon. We definitely want to hear those numbers when they fall. And let's pick this conversation up then.
Definitely. I'm definitely, just please give me a call and I'll be there.
All right. You have a great autumn season and you continue taking care of your family, brother. And I'm going to tell you, you said something today that stuck to me and I'll probably use this, but I will give you credit for it. A parent's job is to make that child independent. And I'm going to tell you what, I can only imagine that your children are going to be good people from that kind of thinking. And that really stuck with me, and I just wanted to bring that up at the end of the show again. That I think that was a very amazing phrase. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Willie, well, everyone, thank you so much for joining us today. And until next time, we'll see you again. We're going to end the show with J.C. Wilkinson, We're Still Here. Thank you for everyone listening. And once again, thank you, Frank Bush and Nell Cole, for producing the show. Have a good evening. Willie, when. Residential school, yeah.
been today. We were broken, beaten down. Teen suicide, addiction's on the rise. And who we once were, oh, ever be found. And remember, we're still here. Educated you, traditional ways, rekindled you. She pains a teacher, oh, and loves a healer. Can we all hold on, oh, to this truth? In the eyes as we pray up to the sky, not over yet, we're part of His plan. So be strong and be proud, stand tall and have no fear, 'cause we're stronger than this. And remember, we're still here. The hearts are strong. What happened was wrong, but as long as one has hope, they will carry on. Look us in the eye as we pray up to the sky. Not over yet, we've heard of His plan. So be strong and be proud, stand tall and have no fear, 'cause we're stronger than this. And remember, we're still here. Remember, we're still here.